With societal trust in media at historic lows and social media still in its relative infancy, significant questions exist about how mainstream and emerging forms of media will evolve in the future. Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. In this podcast, Michael Finnegan, president of Atlantic Media, and Michael Suarez, UVA professor and director of the Rare Book School, discuss recent changes in modern media and examine how content innovation from the past may hold the key for understanding the future.
It's my great privilege to introduce Michael Finnegan. And the key thing to remember here is that it all started at UVA. As a callow youth, Michael Finnegan studied at the University of Virginia for a BA in economics and then an MBA from, yeah, you guessed it, the Darden School of Business. He then spent 10 years as a management consultant specializing in corporate growth and operations. Fatefully then, Michael joined Atlantic Media in 2011, variously serving as COO, CFO, and Senior Vice President of Business Development before becoming president. As the big boss, Michael coordinates strategy, operations, and growth initiatives across the company, which has included the brands The Atlantic, National Journal, Quartz, Government Executive, Ballast Research, and CityLab. During his tenure, the company has more than doubled in size, launched numerous new brands, and completed 5 divestitures. Michael is a director on the board of the Magazine Publishers Association and board chair of Digital Content Next. He asked me to tell you all about his far too brief Little League career, but I said no. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you are honored, as I am, to be in conversation this evening with Michael Finnegan. And I'd like to lead us off not with the Little League career as I was directed by Michael, but with the much more pressing issue, it seems to me, that's probably on everybody's mind. Michael, what is the future of long format journalism? Long format has a deeply distinguished history in our country, starting perhaps with the Federalist Papers. And many of us are worried that long format journalism is going to disappear. We go to The Atlantic partly because of its commitment to long format. What's the future of this, and how do you see things developing over time?
Well, first of all, thank you for the introduction, Michael, and not going into my very brief tooth knocked out Little League career. and thank you to everyone else on here for joining us and to hear us sort of pontificate about what may or may not happen in the future. I mean, if I actually knew, I'd probably be in a much better position than I am. I love the position I am in. I think that for a long period of time, there was fear about sort of the existential nature of long format journalism. You know, you had people like Mark Zuckerberg saying, look, in the future, everything's going to be video. You have companies that I respect very much, like Axios, that are going for smart brevity. And it's sort of like a bullet point format. I think what we've seen over the past several years, though, is that long format will always have a home in, you know, American and the world sort of global media diet. I don't know that it will be the same slice of time as it used to be, because long format is tough and people's days are busier than ever. We've got, you know, we've got these mobile phones right here that are begging for attention at every moment in time. But, you know, in the height of the pandemic a year ago, you know, with some of our long format explainer pieces on what's going on, how the pandemic will end, you know, everyone will get coronavirus. We were seeing 80, 90 million people a month come to The Atlantic, which gives me a lot of faith that long format is not going to go away. I think it will change a little bit. We're, you know, we are working with people to have our long format put into audio. so that you can listen to it while you're on your drive. We're also doing shorter form types of things. So I think that, you know, we're going to see a point in time where you're going to be able to choose the amount of time you want to spend. You want to read up on, you know, one topic for 5 minutes, you're going to have your options for that. You want to go the deep dive and see, you know, the 30 minute read. Hopefully there will be places like The Atlantic or The Economist or many others that are still be doing that. And I think it's important to really get people into it. I don't know. I mean, you know, I love hearing your view, Michael, on the history of it, because if you look back 200 years, in my mind, I think of it all as long format, you know, large novels and treatises. But what do you think the mix has been historically?
Yeah, in fact, when you look at those 18th, early 19th century newspapers, they printed the outer form, you know, it's just one sheet. They printed the outer form the day before, and that's where all the ads were, paradoxically, on the outside. And then they printed the news on the inside because they were holding the sheet. Most of that news is recycled, and most of it is short format. It looks a lot like the front page of the Wall Street Journal in those little tiny paragraphs, right? So that kind of short format, you know, shipping news, boom, 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 business news, boom, 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 political news, court news, country news, it was very compartmentalized and very short format. But it is true that, you know, T.S. Eliot said, where is the knowledge that we have lost in information? Right. And, you know, I worry that my students at UVA who are super bright are really good at information, but they're not so good at knowledge making from information. And maybe our job is to teach them how to take data and to convert it into, you know, information, and to convert information into knowledge, and to convert maybe even knowledge into wisdom, right? So there's this kind of catena or chain information, well, data, information, knowledge, wisdom. And you need the knowledge piece to get to the wisdom piece. And I think that's why long format journalism is super important. But let me ask you, do you envision the future of long format as being digitally delivered, print delivered, audio delivered, a mixed, you know, knowledge economy? How does that play?
You know, I think I've gone back and forth on that for a while. I do think it's going to be a lot more audio delivered. The ability to multitask with audio is a game changer for how busy we are. But there are a lot of periods of time when we can listen while not being able to do anything else. If you're driving a car, you know, if I'm washing dishes, if I'm going for a jog, you know, these are opportunities to take deep dives into information, long format information that doesn't have to take away from everything else. Like, you know, quite frankly, picking up a long form magazine might've done 10 years ago. I used to be a subscriber to The Economist. My dear friend Bob Cohn is the president of The Economist. But I had to stop because it kept stacking up every day every week on my desk. And it insulted me. You're a bad person. Why haven't you taken the time to read me? So I think audio is going to be huge. The print aspect of it, I think print will become more and more of a luxury. People will continue to want it. But, you know, I look at the New York Times, which has grown from like, I don't know the exact numbers, but let's say from over the past 10 years, from something like 1 million subscribers, where 800,000 of those were in print, to I think they're at something like 7 or 8 million subscribers now, where I think only 700,000 are in print. I think digital is the format of the future. I look at my kids when they go up to any screen and they, you know, they try and swipe the screen. They just don't think of interacting with print format the way that you or I do, or probably a lot of people watching this webinar now. I do think there will be a home for print, but it'll be more limited. It'll be, you know, collectible pieces, something that, you know, you display on your bookshelf behind you or on your coffee table, and it won't necessarily be something that you will be receiving daily, weekly, maybe monthly. I could see something like monthly sticking with it, but the you know, the tighter the period, the harder it is. I also want to say, why can't we put the advertising on the outside of anything now? I would have so many advertisers on our door to have their, you know, their ad copy on the outside of any publication.
Sure. You know, this is not a stock recommendation, which we, Michael and I are for, the two Michaels are forbidden to do this, okay? But there's some pretty good data out there that the annualized return on the audiobook industry between now and 2027 is going to be 24.4%. Okay.
Is that for real? I mean, obviously.
That's for real. Now, I'm not making that up. That's, I run this rare book school at the University of Virginia. We're really interested in media history, really interested in what happens to formats over time, right? So my own specialty is on hand press books from about 1550 to 1850. But I'm super interested in this audio trend. And I was reading some papers maybe like a month ago that said 24.4% annualized return. It's going to grow to be a, you know, it's going to grow like, well, 24.4% annualized return, right? So to between now and 2027. So that's huge. What you say about print, Michael, exactly mirrors what happened in the world of manuscript when Gutenberg took over. So 1554 ballpark, we're pretty sure that's the date. Print starts to come on, and some people are resistant, some people love it. But within about 30 years, print starts to dominate because of
what was it before print?
Manuscript.
Oh, yes. Right. I'm sorry.
So like you have like a Kinko's copy shop of a bunch of guys sitting at desks, professional scriveners, scribes. Even the law industry in New York was Bartleby the Scrivener in the 19th century copying out these documents, right? So people start to get really interested in print, and manuscript has to adjust, and it becomes smaller runs and much more elaborate, much more colorful, because print can't do that, much more bespoke, much more niche, much more expensive. And print goes, you know, print goes to the popular market and manuscript goes to the niche high-end market. And I think that's what we're gonna see. I mean, you and I seem to be totally on the same page. That's what print is gonna do. Magazines and books are gonna be more beautiful, more elaborate. And, you know, audio, video, digital delivery is going to become kind of more down and dirty, probably more expedient, maybe. Yeah.
Well, and it's certainly when the expediency is a huge aspect. You know, we one of our publications, National Journal, had a weekly magazine, a wonderful magazine that was around for 40 or 50 years, but the weekly magazines got a little bit tough because they needed to stay on sort of current events enough because it was a weekly magazine. But a lot of times it began to feel like you were reading Monday's news on Thursday.
Right.
And with digital, you get Monday's news the moment it happens. I mean, we're getting the pop-up notifications on your phone. You know, Steve Bannon's been indicted, or this is the Supreme Court ruling on the Texas abortion ban, and you're able to get that information right away. I think that there's a bifurcation of information. There's the things, and I think long form falls into this, the really deeply investigated pieces that take months and months to investigate and get it to the bottom of, or a really deep thought piece that comes over here. And it doesn't matter, you know, we call it evergreen. It doesn't matter necessarily, you know, I would always try and like to try and time it well, but it doesn't necessarily matter if you read it now or you read it 2 months from now. The effect on your thinking and how it challenges you is the same. And then you've got over here, hey, I need to go to a website right now to find out what's going on with X or Y, and I can't wait because I need to know today. And I think information is going to begin to fall into one of those two buckets a little bit more, and you're going to have this dead zone in the middle. And I think maybe actual, in my mind, maybe books and Audible. I mean, you mentioned 24%. I think half my family are getting Audible subscriptions for Christmas. Right. It's such, oh shit, they're probably on here. none of you are getting that.
No, that was a good decoy, Michael.
That was a good, yeah. That was they're really all going to get subscriptions to the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what about the rising creator economy, huh? I treat The Economist like a creator economy, by the way. Like, I know it's an amalgam, but I have to have The Economist, even if I was just reading the obituaries, right? But I treat it less as a monthly magazine and more as just like this great writing that I have to have a dose of. But the creator economy, is going to become more important, where you follow an individual creator instead of following a corporate product per se, right? And I'm just kind of wondering what you think about that a little bit in terms of, you know, the newsletters, the Substack, the kind of, you know, the world that's really changing the environment a lot. And you know, you're so well positioned to talk about that to our audience today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the creator economy, I think, is wonderful for creators. I think it gives them more power in sort of the overall content industry and economy. As a media executive, it is a little bit harder. When you used to acquire readers, say to the Atlantic, they would be there and they became loyal to the brand. Well, now you maybe have a reader that is loyal to Andrew Sullivan. And if Andrew Sullivan writes for the Atlantic or the New Yorker or the Daily Beast or has his own Substack, that person may follow them around. I think it's a good thing for the industry. I think it is caused major media brands to get more creative about the way that they attract talent, incubate talent, compensate talent. That probably makes it a more equitable overall solution. I do think there are things that I worry about in the creator economy in terms of integrity of content. If you've got a storied institution like The Economist or The Atlantic or The New Yorker, they put a lot of time and effort into making sure that they are not violating, you know, all sorts of rules of law, rules of journalism, journalistic integrity. If you've got a single person who is launching a Substack and wants to say whatever they want, their stakes of making a mistake are a little bit different. And I worry, this gets into a much larger conversation, which I would love your view on as well, both from a historical perspective as today. We have a moment in society, I think, where either people are having a harder time differentiating fact from fiction, or what I'm really worried about, just don't want to. They want to consume what they want to believe. And I think storied journalistic institutions for a long period of time would challenge people. Like, we're not going to tell you exactly what you want to believe. We're going to tell you the truth to the best of our ability. You've got all these outlets or content sources or just single creators out there that are saying, hey, you want conspiracy theories on election fraud? I've got this whole thing over here. You want you want a socialist manifesto for how we can turn America into a socialist state. Like, I've got that right over here. And people flock to what they want to hear, when I think what makes us stronger and better as a society and consumers of content is being challenged by stuff that we don't want to hear and challenging ourselves. You mentioned teaching your students. I read just recently that Illinois State is the first state that's going to mandate sort of a media literacy course to help students better separate fact from fiction. Because I think it was something like in a 13 question, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like 70% of US adults could not consistently differentiate fact from fiction. And I think the creator economy brings more money to the creators, but it also creates a little bit of a weird incentive to just chase the money by telling people what they want to hear. And I don't know, like in historically, have you seen that?
I do. The echo chamber problem that you're delineating, I think very well, Michael, is very, very real. And before going historical for a second, I do want to say, I think that at least in the college, which is all I can speak to because that's my whole experience, in the college, I think that professors are teaching some kind of information literacy in every course, particularly in the first and second year. I think that, you know, a lot of what we're doing is teaching people how to read the source and how to discriminate among the sources. So I think that this idea of mandating media literacy, if it's well taught, is super helpful, because once upon a time, I mean, I taught my first college class in 1987. You know, you were worried about, did they know grammar, right? Now you're worried about, sure, you need them to know grammar and you need them to have read something, which isn't always the case. But you need them also to have pretty sophisticated understanding of how to marshal evidence from multiple sources of widely varying reliability. And that takes time to teach, you know, and we shouldn't just, like grammar or like critical reading, we shouldn't be teaching that to 18-year-olds. That should be being taught to, you know, 10-year-olds and 16-year-olds and 18-year-olds and 22-year-olds. So I think that over time that happens. You know, the origin of a lot of journalism, just to circle back to your original observation about those newsletters, a lot of news making in the 17th century, both in France and in England, were these handwritten newsletters. And there would be somebody at court who, if they had 30 subscribers in the country, they could make a go, and they would write the court news and then have those copyists copy it out. But it was always skewed either pro-courtier or pro-king or pro-foreign policy or pro, right? And then this kind of evolved to things like Lloyd's List. Lloyd's mm-hmm. List was a special, you know, insurance newsletter, right? That's what it was for. And you had subscribers dominated by the Lloyd brothers, right? And you know, they did pretty well for themselves. But that happened out of a coffee house in London. You know, it happened at the docks, and it happened in a coffee house for insurance, which would say, these are the ships that have come home. These are the ships we believe are lost. These are the ships that have gone out. And this is our understanding of what their worth is. You know,
in that information, whether it was the court news or the shipping news in London, was worth a lot of money. And so I'm sure people were paying a hefty amount. I love the subscriber sort of business model to bolster advertising business models. I do worry a little bit about if the availability of good information is somewhat predicated on someone's ability to afford it. And what that does is we're sort of polarizing as a society does good news only come to those willing to pay for it? And I know, you know, back then that was clearly the case. You know, I don't know how your peasant in England was getting their news at that point in time, but I'm sure they weren't getting the handwritten, you know.
No.
Sketches.
Yeah, Addison and Steele said that every copy of The Spectator, and they were printing 3,000 of them at a time, they said that every copy of The Spectator was read by or read to 20 people.
Pass-through rate. Media and in magazine media.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, and they were trying to get advertising, right? They were trying to get sponsors. They were trying to get subscribers. They were print is always a fashion commodity, right? Still, right? So if I subscribe to the New York Review of Books, long format out the wazoo for professors, right? And others, that's a kind of, it's not just a thing that helps me do my job. It's a fashion commodity, right? If I'm carrying a copy of The Economist around, that says to people who I am. There's all sorts of social signaling, right? If I'm at a party and I quote Breitbart, right? Or Newsmax, that tells people who I am and what I value and what club I belong to or don't belong to. And I think it's really important as we think about these things as consumer products that we understand that they're markers of value, and increasingly they're markers of values, right? and they say, I belong to this or I belong to that. And that was always true, you know, whether you took the London Review or the Edinburgh Review, told people whether you were a Whig or a Tory. You know, yeah. And that was about book reviews mostly, right? But it told people, you know, to whom you belonged and how you viewed the world. So I'm a little bit concerned, and I want to hear what you have to say. I like the subscriber model, but I worry that it will make news outlets of all kinds, let's say video outlets, let's take it out of print, tell subscribers what they want to hear. You know, I'm worried that it's just going to be about good news and not about news.
I worry completely. I mean, I think I won't go into many of the examples, but there's plenty of examples of publications that lean, you know, to one side or the other, trying to bring some opposing points of view in, and you hear subscriber outcries. I mean, either, you know, you see subscriber cancellations, or you see the publication pull back and maybe decide that they're not going to bring that particular left-leaning or right-leaning commentator or writer on board. I worry a lot about that. I do think that a lot of what you see in digital media are metered paywalls. And so it means that there's a certain number of articles that are available for free. And that means that the information is not completely closed off, but it is limited. I would love to see, and it also means you're a little bit, you become a little bit, you know, just committed to the audience that you have. And I worry that it begins, you know, you lean one way and you get some audience, and then you just sort of find yourself leaning more and more because that's your business model. I do think that for so long, people were worried about advertising, putting journalism in the pocket of big business. I think the two working together means that hopefully the journalism can be as unbiased and as high integrity as possible. And I would also love to see, I've talked about this a lot, and I you know, I think about it a lot. I don't know how I can do it just yet. I would love to see a way where people who don't have the ability to pay for content with money can pay with time by maybe watching an advertisement. Like right now, you see a Volvo ad pops up, and you're reading a story, and you're like, oh, Volvo, let me close out of this. I'm trying to read my story here. And that's not the interaction that the advertiser wants. That's not the interaction the publication wants you to have.
Right.
If you went into a bar and the bartender gave you a beer and you're like, what's this for? And they're like, Volvo bought it for you. You'd be like, what? Way to go, Volvo. That's awesome. Create like a digital wallet where maybe by giving some data over that makes the advertising sort of more hyper-targeted, you can have an interesting relationship with an advertiser and you can say, yeah, thank you for allowing me by watching your 30-second commercial, allowing me to consume this content that I wouldn't otherwise see. And I feel like people in video and broadcast are a little more comfortable with that trade-off. But on digital, it's sort of the original sin of online news journalism is we just sort of put it out there for free. And you've got a generation of news consumers or online content consumers right now that think everything on the internet should be free. And when it's not free,
right,
what's wrong with this? And then I'll say one more thing. I'm getting a little bit rambly, but the risk of only good paid content information sources is there's a lot of people that will flood into that free zone. But I think what we've seen is these are your bad actors. These are your misinformation people that will make up some weird register name for the city that you live in. And their goal is not to make money. Their goal is to pump information out that has even more nefarious purposes. And if all the best information, either right-leaning or left-leaning, goes into these sort of paid lockboxes, you're going to have a lot of people that are just consuming this free bad information that's feeding their worst instincts, their worst desires, and creating a more divisive situation.
You know, I think that is extremely perspicacious analysis. You know, we were worried 15 years ago, 10 years ago about the digital divide, right? You know, who has and who doesn't have access. And it's still, I mean, in rural America, that's still a concern that I have and many policymakers have. I'm sure you do too. But it's
110 billion for broadband though, right?
Right. It's true. It's true. Yeah. As of
that won't get us all the way there, but it'll get us closer.
Yeah, no, it's going to help. But I do worry about this information divide or journalistic access divide. And I wonder if you could comment for the audience, putting you in a tough spot here. But, you know, you are the president of Atlantic Media. I'm going to ask you to comment on the business model of another highly intelligent publication. Tell me what you think about The Guardian. I think what The Guardian is doing is really significant, but nobody else seems to be following suit. So, you know, you're in the driver's seat in a way that nobody else is. What do you think?
Yeah, we've sold most of our publications. So we have, I have minority stakes and I'm not as much in the driver's seat as I used to be, but I have thought a lot about The Guardian. I think it's very interesting. I think there are difficulties with that model becoming very ubiquitous, largely because of the ownership structures of other media companies. I mean, you've got The Atlantic, for example, which is owned by Emerson Collective. You've got Time, which is owned by Mark Benioff. You've got, The New York Times, which is a publicly traded company. We could go on and on. The Guardian is a trust, as a nonprofit, I think it's a little bit more okay to put your hand out and say, "Hey, support us." I think some of these owners that I just mentioned may not be interested necessarily in generating humongous returns for themselves. I think they may be more interested in just supporting great journalism, but they do want, sort of journalistic and media outlets that are self-sustaining. And it's a little weird when you're going out to some of your consumers and your readers and say, hey, we'd really like a little bit of money. And if they come back and they look in, okay, well, where's that money going? It's going to shareholders? Oh, it's going to a single wealthy individual? With The Guardian, with it going to the trust, I makes it unique. But I've been amazed. And I think, Vox.com, I believe, did something similar, maybe at the start of the pandemic, just sort of put up a donation page, not even a subscription. They just said, if you like this, support us. And, you know, by all accounts that that I've read, it did quite well. I do think that there are people out there that love to support journalism. I just don't know that it's, I don't know that it's a business model that is going to be much greater than a subscription business model, which I think is a great consumer play because of its intellectual honesty. I'm creating a great product. You're going to pay for this product because you think it's worth the money that that we're going to exchange for it. And then I think advertising as well. I worry a little bit about how sustainable advertising is as Google and Facebook eat larger and larger shares, and you've got Amazon and Snapchat and TikTok and some of these others that are coming in. It makes it harder for sort of the smaller, more independent places to compete. But I think those are still going to be better in the long run and better for the ultimate product than sort of a donation model.
Sure. Sure. And what about the devil's bargain of selling my data, right? Because that's another model, right? That, you know, if I'm online and you're looking at the advertising I'm consuming, you're looking at how long my eyeballs are on this piece or that piece or the other piece, your analytics can drive a lot to me, right? Mm-hmm. What about that as a future for journalism? You know, sell the reader's data. That's a, many people regard that as a complex ethical question.
I love some, I mean, even though it's very difficult, I love the fact that we're talking about this. I think Europe put GDPR, which is the global data protection rights, PR, you got the California Privacy Act. I think being transparent about what you're doing with data and what that trade-off looks like, I think in the long run, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, $100 subscription and we don't take any data, or you can get, you know, you can let us use your data and you get a $25 subscription and you're actually taking a benefit there. I also think some of this data is actually really clever in making us work more efficiently, you know, get me to my search results faster. I don't have to spend nearly as much time researching a vacation because the algorithms can sort of direct me in the right way. I think that there are people of our generation that are probably a little more concerned about the data, and understandably so. I don't begrudge anyone that. You know, there are, you know, people who are 20 years my junior who have 30 apps on their phone and each one opt into the data tracking and they don't care. And they're putting out things on social media that their desire for privacy is different than you know, a Gen X or a baby boomer sort of generation desire for privacy. So I think you'll bifurcate a little bit as all of these companies get more sophisticated, and as you have more regulation. I think regulation, the worst thing I can imagine as an executive is you have the California Privacy Rights Act and the Vermont Privacy Rights Act and the Alabama Privacy Rights Act. That will drag everything to a halt. Like, create one federal regulation the way that the European Union's done. It might be a little bit burdensome and unwieldy, but it'll create one standard that is the same wherever you are.
Sure. Because then you can be in compliance and it's not primarily about just the lawyers, it's about the journalism.
Yep.
Sure. Michael, I think we're ready to go to Q&A if that suits you. Yeah?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, I'm still not going to tell about your Little League career and the story of the lost tooth, all right? So, but I think they did a great job. Doesn't everybody think they did a good job on Michael? Anyway, the reconstruction.
It was a late baby tooth. I think.
Yeah, I understand.
It was coach pitch, and my coach said we really needed a runner on base, so he had to beam me.
Hit you with a pitch. Yeah, sure. Let's begin with Charlie, who asks, Well, how do you define audio broadly? A combination of podcasts and long form writing read aloud by hired voiceover talent, or do we think of audio as something more complex?
Right now, I think it more. I think of it less complex. I think, you know, you've got podcasts. I think you've got the hired voice actor that are reading. You've also the other thing, and this, maybe this is a little bit more complex, but it's also a little bit more simple. You've got some AI that is doing very impressive text to voice, and so for a while there, it was hard to hire a voice actor to read everything, and so you might only hire it for things that you really thought were going to be very valuable for the consumer. Now you can get AI that will read almost everything, and it's getting, the voice acting is getting more, or the AI voiceovers are getting more and more, or less and less robotic, and hitting the dramatic pauses and learning how to actually deliver a great, you know, 8,000 word long form cover story in a way that it was meant to be delivered, and that you would consume it if you were reading it. I don't know. Michael, do you think of it something more complex than that? I may be missing something.
You know, I don't think I do. I think that I think that the audio delivery, whether it's a series of short pieces, a podcast, iTunes U, you know, and all those lectures for free now that you can pick up on various mm-hmm. sources, right? Khan Academy has mm-hmm. a video aspect, but you know, you can also just turn it on and do the dishes, as you say, or you know, drive in the car. So I think of audio as being just about anything that's delivered that way. And there's so many devices, you know, there's so many devices that we could use to do that. And I do think that's a huge piece of the journalistic and beyond, you know, infrastructure, ecosystem, whatever metaphor you want to use. I think audio is absolutely key for the future. So even as the Washington Post kind of has done an excellent job in building the video aspect of their newspaper, the next piece is probably the audio piece, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and you see, I mean, you may have, if you are subscribed to the New York Times, they've got this new service, Audm, AUDM, that I don't know everything they're doing, but I think what they're trying to do is fully audio, make audio all of their journalism. And I think that's where you'll see a lot of people, and you'll have people who will still want to read in print. You'll have people who will still want to read on their desktop or on their tablet or their phone, but you'll have more and more people who are saying, yeah, I want to consume an hour and a half of New York Times journalism, but the only way I can do that is if I'm multitasking while I'm exercising or driving or doing dishes or whatever else. And I think that is a great utility to provide for your readers and your users, your listeners.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Here's a question that you can say pass on. Okay. This is a question from the audience. And you know, I described you as the big boss, and you can kind of say like, yes, I want to answer that, or no, I don't. So Anonymous asks, what's the process at Atlantic Media for folks to pitch new projects or business model opportunities? Is there a mechanism for people? I'm gonna modify the question a little bit, or bifurcate the question. Is there a model for internal people to come and say, hey, I've worked here for 20 years and I have a great idea that you're not paying attention to, sort of Japanese management principle at work? Yep. Or, you know, to take the question in a different slice, is there a way for outside people to come and pitch in some way to this robust and distinguished corporation?
From an external perspective, the only real pitching that happens, and it varies, the rules vary at each publication, but it is sort of like editorial pitches. So all of our publications have outside contributors that write for them on occasion, and all of them have, you know, if it's government executive, if it's national journal, and I say ours, I mean our legacy publications, because so many of them have new owners now. Internally, the way that when I was running all of it, internally the way we would do it is, we would do a long range planning process that every middle of the year, say June, there was a lot of sort of public call for strategic initiatives, and there was a winnowing down and a filtering process where people could mention things to their boss, their bosses could bring them up, and a whole host of ideas would come up. We, as a holding company entity, and myself and my management team, would look at a lot of the ideas, and we'd have our own sort of strategic directions, and we'd say, these don't fit and these don't fit. And then you'd sort of vet the ones that still fit and work them down, and you'd end up by budget time in say November, having selected, a variety of strategic initiatives. But it was, I really feel like what we did well was having a decentralized strategy process that allowed some of these ideas to come up. The president before me, I think, did a really good job. He really shifted us from print to digital. He's the CEO of Bloomberg Media now. But at that point in time, a lot of what he had to do, because it was a major cultural shift, is really grab the steering wheel and say, hey, this is the future. This is how we're moving. I frankly had it a little bit easier. Everyone saw the future, and it was just about like, hey, let's innovate. And so ideas came up, and it was a great way to get some wonderful ideas. And then sometimes ideas were formed at the top and sort of filtered down through the organization.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you a follow-up, if I may. I run this tiny little 501c3 rare book school, which, is this international academy. People are coming from all over the world to study books and manuscripts and digital forensics and so on. Right. And we're constantly, we have more good ideas than we can implement. Right. And that's a question of bandwidth, but it's also a question of opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, do you think as the president, do you think a lot about opportunity cost as an operative leadership principle, as an operative business principle? Is that, because there are too many opportunities, or?
I think there are too many opportunities, and I don't know that it's, there are budgetary constraints, but I think it's just organizationally. If you try to pursue 20 or 5 or 30 strategic initiatives, you end up doing 25 things in a mediocre fashion. I'd rather choose 5 things and just nail it to the wall and say, we are going to be better than anyone else at these 5 things. Because I think in anything that you do, there's the top spot and maybe the next spot or two. Like when you think of your apps that you go to for news, there's not that many people who are like, oh, here are my 14 news apps or maybe 3. And if you don't make your way into those top 2 or 3, I think you're sort of dead in the long run. And so I think focus on doing a couple things to an exemplary level and just choose the things that you're most passionate about and confident about. Because if you try and do too much, you end up just not getting anything done.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I like that a lot. I have this little speech I give toward the end of my every course that I teach at UVA, where I turn on the light, I turn off the light, I turn on the light, I turn off the light, I turn on the light, I turn off the light in the classroom. And students are like, what the heck are you doing, Suarez? And then I say, here's the deal. I want to ask you today what kind of light you want to be. Because you can be these converted fluorescent now LEDs, right? And you could do a good job for the rest of your life. Said, but that's one kind of role in the culture. So, but for my part, I want to be a laser, which is amplified and focused and amplified and focused and amplified and focused through a ruby, right? You know, through a ruby, you know. And I say, you know, the laser can cut through a steel door, but it can also heal a child's eye. So what are the costs for becoming laser-like, you know, and how do you wield what you've been given? And I think that's a business principle as well as an ethical principle, which is what I'm trying to convey to them.
I think that there's a lot of people that you know, we use it like rays of sun, and you pick the one or two that you're really good at, and you go as far out those rays of sun as possible. I will add a caveat to that. And I actually spoke 3 or 4 years ago at a Darden event on this. I do think utility players and well-rounded players, and I put myself in this boat, in my organization, there is someone better than me at everything that we do. But you need to have someone who knows enough about everything that they sort of get their arms around things and steer it. But that's not for everyone, but that is an important function. And I spoke about this with the Trisector Leader Fellows at UVA, which are specifically looking at business and law and innovation and leadership, the Batten School. And so I do want to say that not everyone, you know, needs to go off and laser focus, but I do agree with you in general, you're going to get more done with laser focus than you are with a little bit here, a little bit there.
Yeah. I mean, you and I don't know each other well, but I would characterize your leadership style, Michael, as laid back intensity. So it might not be about knowing a ton about the one thing, but there is a degree of intensity of focus in terms of what you're about, right?
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and it might be something that might be the kind of comparison. Chris asks a really interesting question. And entirely germane to what we've been talking about, Michael. Chris asks, what would it take to expand the revenue model of public-sponsored journalism like the BBC in the UK, which of course is a subscription model, we shouldn't forget, right? You gotta pay for your license, you know? Mm-hmm. Or PBS domestically, which is, you know, the fund drive model, as well as some government funding. Both of them have government funding. So,
right.
So Chris would say, what does it take, do you think, to get more dollars into publicly funded journalism?
That's a good question. I only know a little bit about the publicly funding process, but I know enough from the people who do it that specifically the dollars from the government are really hard to come by. And this is even, you know, something for the University of Virginia. I can't remember exactly what I read, but at one point in time, I think it was like only 7 or 8% of the operating budget actually comes from the state of Virginia. I think there are very similar numbers for like a PBS or an NPR or something like that. I think it takes a belief on society at large that these sorts of things are important. I think if it comes specifically from the government, you risk just a lot of distrust if the money comes from the government. So the more that it can come from society and the members of society, the better. I think these also do a good job of, you know, there's a variety of wealthy individuals who are buying media properties. There are many, many more who are giving millions of dollars to these sort of public journalistic organizations. I don't know if I have a really good answer. Another one of our Darden fellows is Paula Kerger, who is the CEO of PBS. I would suggest that Darden have her back to talk a little bit about the publicly funded media models, because I would love to hear more about that.
You bet. Yeah. Let's do one more real quick, if we can. Very briefly. I think what we could do, Michael, if you're going to agree, is that we could end at 7:30 on time per our instructions. But if more questions do come in, we can stick around and kind of dot the ball around a little bit beyond the time. If that's okay with you, I don't see.
I just got to watch the Who's play Houston at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, no, oh, I get it. That's the only thing. It's important, especially now with 9 players in the rotation instead of 7. Right, we need to see who's who. We got to figure this out. So
absolutely,
totally with you. Francisco asks, and we'll do this very briefly. Is there a way that newsletters have become one of the key monetizers, as Morning Brew has done, or what the Wall Street Journal offers with several of their email newsletters?
I still don't think they're key monetizers yet. I think they're becoming much more important. And some people are out in front of this. I think Morning Brew is one, for those of you who know Axios, I think, and even Politico, they got way out front with their newsletters. I think a lot of other organizations use newsletters as a part of their marketing funnel in how they create habitual engagement that they hope to actually ultimately use to convert to a subscription. Some people like Substack newsletters and things like that are saying, no, the newsletter is the product and it's what you're going to pay for. I think a lot of other media organizations historically have said, hey, you come to our site 5 times a month. Why don't you sign up for the newsletter that we're going to send you every night or every morning? And once you start using that, we sort of say, hey, look, you actually really love us. Like, you should subscribe. And that's how they sort of work you down from a casual passerby to a habitual newsletter to an actual subscriber. Now, all that said, there have been a variety of entities, The Atlantic, one of them, just recently announced a new subscriber-only newsletter. I think they launched with like 9 subscriber-exclusive newsletters. And the idea is that will be part of your benefit as a subscriber, and it will not be free. And that's what Substack said as well. And I'm interested to see how that works out. I do worry a little bit about, I subscribe to so many newsletters and they just get stuck in my inbox. Those weekly issues of The Economist that pile up and taunt me.
And they don't get open. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Sure. So headline is newsletters are the gateway drug for the big product, right? And they're the hook. And that may change over time. My job is briefly to sum up. And I think that some of the takeaways are there are profound ethical issues at stake in the future of journalism in America and worldwide. I think also we need to think about this information divide. Is complex, thoughtful journalism on whatever side of the political spectrum only for people who can afford to pay for it? And is there a huge kind of no man's land that'll just be filled with malicious actors, people who are driving ideologies? That's a really important question. And then I think the one consistent thing we can think of is that probably we haven't mentioned any huge technological change on the horizon, but that the technologies are being deployed in new and innovative ways over time. And that the one thing we can say about the media landscape, other than asserting its importance, its ethical complexity, the worries that you and I share about the economics of it and access, might be that it's going to continue to change over time. And that we as consumers need to be dynamic in our responses to that. So we've come just a little bit past time. We're really excited to have such a good audience tonight. We want to thank Michael for his perceptive comments, and you could see why he's in the position he's in. And I want to remind the audience that the next Leadership Unscripted is a conversation with Baroness Stroud and Lucy Bassett. It's going to be about grassroots organizing to policy changes, confronting complex social challenges. It's going to be at 12 p.m. EST on the 9th of December, and you can register through the website. Please join me then in thanking Michael Finnegan for his amazing comments tonight. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Leadership Unscripted is a Darden speaker series hosted at UVA Darden DC Metro in Arlington, Virginia. To learn more, visit us at darden.virginia.edu.